All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.
Good evening. Welcome to John Bowd's All the Rage. We're live again. This has been a funny old day because I think most of the world have been watching something in the US. Really bizarre, actually, because I think the world has been watching, which we normally wouldn't. It's just normally full of pomp and ceremony. It was a bit sparse, filled up to the teeth with security for obvious reasons. You don't want any Jamiroquais running up the stairs, do you? Bear Jamiroquai, someone said. I don't know. Apparently he's vegetarian, that geezer. He's in jail, he's incarcerated, and he's insisting on vegetarian only.
I heard he was insisting on organic, actually.
Organic. Oh, I do apologise, John. I do apologise.
No, it's probably the same thing. He was just saying something about, he was going on about only having organic food or whatever.
And apparently a very rich... real estate agent who took a private jet to the invasion, a terrorist invasion, mm-hmm. Let's make that clear, and she's been incarcerated and charged, and she wants to be pardoned because she spent a lot of money getting there to liberate America. So I quite rightly put up her concerns on Facebook, and it wasn't met very well. I heard Steve Bannon got pardoned today. I think I'm full of good news here with John. John, I think let's hope that I'm not scripted this show at all. John, I'm just getting a bit of paper. I've known John for some time, so I can read him well, but I'm just going to write down the stuff that we're going to talk about as he does it live, kids. We're live. I'm going back to the music. This Saturday, brand new show from 6 p.m. UK time, Richie G's House Education Show live. John, take it away.
Lovely, thanks, mate. Well, we will talk about some of the events of today, whether they be monumentous or otherwise, but we'll get to that. I don't want to peek too early. To be honest, there's a number of things I think are far more important on any given week. And that I just got to say though the woman flying in a private jet and that basic annoyance that even just being hassled by doing what they were doing, never mind arrested, that they have is just the absolute epitome of privilege. It really is. And again, when people, I get really agitated when people feign not understanding white privilege and stuff like that, and it's just like to be honest, on something like that, you either get it or you don't. I know that's not the best attitude. Some people will scold me for not trying to connect with people on a different level. But really, when you're seeing something like that, when you think you have anything in common with someone that rich, I don't know what to say to you. But we've been doing a few trade union issues in the last couple of weeks, and I'm going to speak to a couple of others to begin with. So let's start with the firefighters. Because it's stories like these that don't get heard enough when we're, obsessing over the minutiae of what a truly, dementia-ridden now ex-president had for breakfast this morning or whatever else you want to write about. Matt Rack, the General Secretary of the Fire Brigades Union, the FBU, recently wrote a piece for Tribune magazine online discussing the betrayal of firefighters by their bosses during this pandemic. Fire service employers have withdrawn from a safety agreement, something that RAC sees very much as in line with their unscrupulous behaviour and how they, like many bosses, have used the COVID-19 crisis to push even further attacks on workers' rights. RAC writes that during COVID-19, it should be more vital than ever to protect communities and workers. I think that's something that's fairly uncontroversial. Firefighting is one of the vital emergency services in the land, and they have worked with the NHS and the care sector to aid people in getting through these terrible times, among other things. To directly quote Matt Rack on this one from the article, For 10 months, an agreement between the Fire Brigade Union and employers has allowed firefighters to safely assist the communities through this crisis, their communities, excuse me, through this crisis. Across the country, while many firefighters continue to tackle fires, floods and other hazardous incidents, we helped firefighter volunteers to swap their fire engines for ambulances, step in to stem infections in care homes, deliver essential items to the vulnerable and move the bodies of the deceased. End of quote. Also throughout this time, the FBU has worked with the national employers, which comprises fire authorities from England and Wales and board appointees from Scotland and Northern Ireland, and the national fire chiefs, to ensure the highest safety standards possible. So far, there have been relatively fewer infections within the Fire and Rescue Service compared to other frontline services, with the first death within that sadly occurring but only this month. This prevention is down to the work of FBU union reps ensuring the implementation of safety services. Firefighters returning from high-risk environments must receive a negative coronavirus test before returning to their fire station. This level of safety for both firefighters and the public they serve has been undermined recently by the bosses. So Rack again writes, quote, they decided they do not want firefighters to have to wait for a negative test result before returning to normal duties. The FBU proposed a range of alternative safety measures, but employers rejected every single one. End quote. Later on, the fire service employees unilaterally withdrew from the agreement while the union was trying to negotiate a compromise. So let me repeat that. That's fire service employers have decided in the middle of a pandemic to remove agreed national safety standards and abdicate responsibility for firefighter safety. Rack has said this is a blatantly political action. He writes, employers have been advised by the National Fire Chiefs Council, who in turn are in close communication with the Home Office. This is a case of bosses and the Tory government choosing a time when communities are most vulnerable and when firefighters want to do all they can to help to stick the boot into the trade union. End of quote. They don't like meeting basic safety standards or negotiate about any of the situations they put firefighters in, no matter the level of danger. So this is about watering down the standards, which is our old enemy, of course, the race to the bottom. FBU officials are still trying to keep the agreement alive, but RAC has called for support from the entire trade union and labour movements and has added, and again, another quote, there are Labour Party councillors within the fire services national employers and there are Labour fire authority members across the country. They can and must speak up for this agreement. So, yeah, let's all make sure we can provide the support in any way we can for the FBU. The attack on safety provisions is likely to increase even more. In the last week or so, we've seen the Conservative government carry on with their war against the working class by looking to shred the 48-hour working week and open workers in Britain to any number of rights being further stripped away, including the red tape, as they like to see it, of safety provisions. We know perfectly well this was the master plan behind the campaign to leave the European Union all along. So for those of you that made this happen, I hope your children disown you and I hope you die alone. I have another piece, Dave, but did you want to talk about that one before I go on to this one?
No, it's I think as we get sort of to the wedge end of not the wedge end, because I don't know what end it is in regards to the current situation and the science of it and this awful thing that's happening to us. But as we get to the wedge end of their bank accounts and costs and spreadsheets and all year-on-year cumulative spend and all that crap, as you know, John, we're going to see nationalised industries getting the whack of that first. We're already seeing that with private workers and self-employed, which who were attacked straight away. And they are predicting we're going to see levels of unemployment in March bigger than it was in 1982 or 1981-82. John?
Yeah, we most certainly are. You know, I think plenty of places have spelt this out, so we don't need to do it any more than anyone else. But just look at the content of our shows since this year began, if not plenty of them from last year. You know, this is a direction these things are going in. really, you know, cut the bullshit. What are you actually going to do about this? You know, are you going to join up with the rest of us and fight back against it and try and provide an alternative, of which there's many now? You know, don't listen to people when they say, oh, you know, you haven't provided an alternative. I mean, this story I've just read out is a classic example. You've got the trade union who are trying to maintain safety standards, and they are in the middle of negotiations, and they've provided, you know, their alternative actually in this case is really simple. Keep up the present safety provisions because they seem to have worked phenomenally well. So why not carry on? And in the middle of negotiations, they shut down. They've obviously got an agenda going on here. In regards to cutting not only the fire brigades union, but also for, you know, the other stuff they're trying to cut from people's rights and standards, as I said at the end. So,
yeah, as I said, John, before this pandemic, local councils and local boroughs councils, HSE or health and safety departments, their field officials, the ones that would go to, once a complaint is made, they would go and visit the workplace, they were stripped to the bone anyway. So they went into it really badly, but I must say, due to trade unions, we are seeing things like furlough, extension of the furlough, vulnerable, full pay whilst being vulnerable, and support for those. That's come from the trade unions, and of course the through our affiliation to the opposition, who of course the current administration does rely on the opposition for votes, which is really odd, John.
Yeah, isn't it just? How can you have a 70-odd or 80-odd majority and you're still relying on the opposition? Also, more importantly, they shouldn't be relying on the opposition because the opposition shouldn't be bloody supporting them. That's the point. But what do I know? just some basics about that sort of thing. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Dave, to like outline all of that stuff. You know, where are these gains and benefits coming from? Well, we'll say it every week, really, won't we, I suppose? They're coming from trade unions. It's obviously the best way to get work done. Actually, speaking of trade unions, East London Strippers Collective, a big shout out to our comrades in this union. You'll probably know them best from their co-founder, Stacey Clare, who comes on this show all of the time, and a big shout out to her. And this week, they did an online life drawing event. Now, this is one of the events they set up physically many years ago in a pub in East London. So people could, in this case, you could log on and draw, not quite the same as the experience of going to it in the flesh, if you pardon the term, but that is where we are at the moment. So I logged on just to show a bit of solidarity and pop them a bit of money. And yeah, it's an interesting event. So it's basically life drawing if you're into that kind of stuff, which is, you know, obviously drawing the human body and everything. And they, you know, pull various poses for certain periods of time to allow you to draw. I actually can't draw, so I've got no idea how easy this is via Zoom. It seemed a little, you know, obviously the visuals aren't great, but if it worked for people, I really hope so. But just to give you an example, it's one of the events they're doing because, of course, their particular trade has been very heavily hit in this pandemic. So they are generally, of course, sex workers are generally getting better organised. You will, of course, know that from, you know, the various, every time Stacey Clare comes on here, she's got loads of interesting things to talk about, you know, so it makes me feel quite minor in all of the work she's done in between the last time we spoke to her and the next, you know. And yeah, they've set up online parties too with an organization called CyberTees, which is again a sort of you know, organized collective of strippers, so I'm very happy to support them and big them up there. So where did I get the is it called My Meat or something? I tell you what, actually, go to their website. I'll give you the details at the end. But CyberTees themselves have another event coming up on the 28th of January. And you can sign up for that at Eventbrite, if you're interested. So it's a CyberTees Circus Edition in conjunction with Queer House Party, with DJs and all that good stuff, which is, yeah, go check it out. And obviously, hello to all our good friends over there. I was going to tell you some other info, Dave, about hopefully we've got somebody from United Voices of the World coming on again. But I'd let's just get those things sorted before, let's not front announce them just in case they don't happen. But yeah, that could be good. Right, I've got another issue. Did you want to feedback on that before I did? Or?
No, John, and I look forward to our brothers and sisters from UVW.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all good moves. Okay, so that's some positive news. People obviously organising for themselves and working out how best they can get through the pandemic while still, you know, staying independently funded. Now, what should we talk about next? Oh, okay. Let's talk about Elon Musk. Dear God. Okay. Taking attention away from Jeff Bezos for a while, because we've been kicking the shit out of him on this show for a few weeks, we'll talk about the equally disgusting piece of human shit in the shape of the moon-faced man-goblin. That is Elon Musk. I was on one when I wrote this. Now, he has become the world's richest person with a supposed net worth of $175 billion. Again, everybody, this is not an amount of money that it is possible to earn. Okay. This has come about through inherited wealth and his electric car company, Tesla, a company that has only gone into profit this year. Before, it was spending more than it actually made. Not one of many companies that does that, actually. He has already expressed an interest in colonizing Mars, among various other mad ideas. Now, there's many greatly dislikable things about Musk. But aside from being the overprivileged scion of white supremacy and exploitation of black South Africans, aside from being a grifter with a horrible ego, and aside from being a billionaire, which in itself is disturbing, the actually most disturbing thing about him is he's a psychopath, a deeply dangerous man with far too much power and under no democratic control whatsoever. His space adventures are helping to heat the already too hot Earth that we all live on, and no one is attempting to stop him, because aside from all of the power being drained from our political institutions to the benefit of someone like this, too many politicians kiss his ass anyway, especially in America. They all seem to think he's some kind of genius. We've said before that it really just shows how badly wrong and twisted a society can be when it admires people like this. His wealth is built on fraudulent ideas. He did not amass this wealth through his own solitary genius, as he and his kind would like you to believe. He is a union buster, and he has violated plenty of health and safety standards along the way, such as when he opened the Tesla factories in violation of local COVID-19 lockdown rules in California. The state later changed the rules to accommodate him. He tried to open his factories as vital services. Not quite sure who they were vital services to, other than him, but there you are. He doubled down on shitting all over this state of California by claiming that he was going to provide ventilators, and he basically gave them the wrong ones while he was still being celebrated for his staggering level of altruism. He's not even the real co-founder of Tesla. He, in fact, bought that label through an out-of-court settlement from the real founders. Oh, and $4.9 billion of government subsidies that he's also had. So nice to see some form of socialism is alive and well. His family were involved in the emerald mining trade in South Africa, a business central to the economic fabric of apartheid, and also shot through with the brutal exploitation and violence towards its black South African workforce to this day. Mining industry is horrendous there. I doubt Musk will hear what I and others have said about him, and even if he did, he would no doubt take to Twitter and call me a pedo, because that is the level of intellect and maturity that he has. Such a very admirable and overtly rich people like him always are in this way. Such an admirable person. This tech billionaire subsection is easily the scariest thing right now outside of the virus itself. There is a disturbing cult around people like him, more stone bleeders pretending that they are reinventing the wheel, while really they are just savaging everything they need to, that we need to exist, and telling us that this is the latest, greatest achievement for humanity. I don't really understand any way of being anything other than just richly cynical about the, you know, kind of tech giants and the brilliance of this, that, and the other. Mainly because I think in a world where, you know, economic collapse, environmental collapse is on the way, and we've just had this, you know, still in the middle of this terrible, terrible pandemic, to hear somebody waffle on about their latest techno gadget invention of brilliance just kind of leaves, at the very least, a fairly sour taste in the mouth. But yeah, I thought it was worth highlighting. Whenever somebody like this, I don't normally bother going on about whether, you know, someone's become richer than someone else, I don't care, but I do find a great deal of problems with people like him. And we have been doing a thing on the show, and we've been highlighting some people who have been making quite a bit of money during these terrible times, and usually at other people's expenses, and we'll have a little bit more on that later on. But yeah, Dave, do you want to?
No, I have read up a lot on that gentleman. One of those people, he's not. I just sometimes think we didn't mean to do it, But I sometimes think we focus the media on these donuts, these awful people. And there are some good stories, and certainly in technology, where the smaller companies, the smaller R&D, research and development companies, do celebrate their success with their workers. There tend to be far not enough successes, but you will find that certainly in the UK, the top 44 FTSE companies are unionised. So they're successful, they're making money, and they're unionised. So that's a positive thing. John?
Great. And I mean, look, technology has helped us come up with vaccines, you know, as quickly as they have been come up with. That's quite something, you know, it's quite impressive. The methods by which they are brought out and brought to market, which by very nature is they shouldn't be, they should be free. But nevertheless, you know, lots of companies have dug in and made a benefit off of that, off of our back, because as we've outlined before, these things were always government subsidised, which means they're public money. So for Pfizer and BioNTech and AstraZeneca and other people to sweep in and take profit off it is very, very disgusting and something they shouldn't be able to get away with. But, you know, that technology is there. There's plenty of, you know, the ability to actually stop this unrelenting struggle towards, you know, destruction if we want to. In fact, interestingly, I thought I'd just read out this next, in line with your answer to that, this next piece that I wrote down. So obviously when I was looking into this, this other story popped up that I had missed just before the end of last year. US and Canada auto workers welcome GM and Fiat Chrysler investment. This is from the Industrial website late in last November, I think it was. It was announced late last year, that Fiat Chrysler and General Motors would be investing in unionized factories building electric cars. This follows a period of factory shutdowns and slowed sales for the industry. On the 20th of October, Terry Dittes, I hope I pronounced that right, is the UAW International Vice President, announced an agreement with General Motors on plans to invest $2 billion US dollars into six US plants and modernize the Spring Hill, Tennessee assembly plant to build the next generation all-electric vehicles. The Tennessee site, organized by UAW Local 1853, will build the new electric crossover Cadillac, I'm going to pronounce this Lyric. It's L-Y-R-I-Q, so I think that's right, the Cadillac Lyric. While members of UAW Local 602 in Delta Township, Michigan, will build the new generation Arcadia. I've got a little quote here. The day before, on October the 19th of October, members of Canadian Union Unifor at Fiat Chrysler and Brompton Etobicoke, I think that's right, sorry, Windsor, Messenger, Montreal and Red Deer ratified a 78% majority new three-year collective bargaining agreement with the auto company. The agreement also includes significant investment, job security and economic gains for workers. That's straight from the article itself. So this shows a likely shift towards electric vehicles is looking far more likely in the future. Very interesting if you look at the way that the oil industry through the car industry killed them off back in the 80s or so when we could have really helped them. But it will still be of good use going forward and it will absolutely be necessary. This shows that companies and unions can work together on vital progressive processes like this. So I thought that was well worth mentioning. I'm sorry it took me so long to find it, but we've highlighted it now. So technology again, Dave, like you say, something beneficial, the electric car, we're gonna need them if we're gonna have cars at all. That's just, you know, it's going forward.
Absolutely, John. Just on this current lockdown or semi-lockdown or people not cooperating and so forth, I must say the air seems to be cleaner. We've had a very cold spell this winter, which normally it is not a good thing in winter to have warm spells. It's not. It's just, it does things, having cold, good, strong cold spells. Don't ask me what, but it does. And it just seems things are out. There was an owl in, I haven't heard an owl in my garden for like 20 years.
Awesome.
There was an owl. It annoyed the hell out of me, but he was there. There he was. Twitter wooing.
It's a great, wonderful moment when nature came home, and then like Tommy's like, "Okay, shut up, you fucking stupid bird." This.
It reminded me of a Scooby Doo, you know, episode, you know, the owl and all that. But
no, but I mean, yeah, you got a good point. Is that, yeah, I mean, firstly, you know, we need the, you know, the winter needs to be cold, and summer's preferably not as warm as they are now. This is part of the, you know, the ecosystem. If you'll pardon me if I'm using the wrong terms with this, I sort of understand environmental issues without always knowing the right terms. But yeah, you know, it's vital to keep your ecosystem sane. You've got to stop killing things off. Dear God, you've got to stop killing off the bees, because we're really fucked if the bees go. So yeah, it's a wondrous thing if we don't mess it up. It's a wondrous thing to be around.
Yeah, there's just before we move on, there's a brilliant program by David Attenborough. It won awards and stuff, talking about the balance of nature and how the balance, and we're getting more animals that would normally be eaten, like rats and mice and smaller things like that. We've stripped down a certain type of animal to curb that. And those little things are spreading the disease, apparently. It was an amazing, amazing program. It's on everything at the moment. Do track it down, Life on Earth. And it's got a specific title. And what he says is makes sense. Balance, we're talking about balance in the ecosystem, in the environment, living things. And the balance has gone the other way, and things that shouldn't happen has happened, and it's created a chain effect of other stuff. And he does talk about the COVID virus as well, which I think we had a guest on talking about that as well, John.
Yeah, I was going to say, this was something that Rob talked about when he was on his show late last year, where he talked about the vultures, and he said that the manner in which, well, so he was talking specifically about some of the drugs that are being given to cows in parts of India and places where they, you know, they're dying and they're suffering, and obviously out of you know, a decent sense of kindness, some people give them these drugs in order to make their pain less. The problem is when they do die, they're then put on scavenge sites, and the drugs that are in them are extremely dangerous to vultures. They need a very small amount and it kills them off. So vultures are hugely important scavengers within the ecosystem. And again, as you said, a similar example, that's when they're dying off, that's being replaced, or they're not, you know, maybe they're starting to learn not to go near these cows. They're being replaced by rats and other stuff, which is not the preferable manner. We need the vultures to do it. So yeah, it's exactly what I thought of actually when you were saying that, was the vultures a very good example of you know, messing around with the system and the amount of unforeseen, to begin with, at least unforeseen damage that it does, you know. So. Okay, another thing that popped up, just I thought worth mentioning. I normally, you know, normally on this show, and we'll get back to this soon, we normally focus on one particular issue that we sort of travel in, inwards and outwards and all around. I've just picked up a few things this week that I thought were worthy of mention. And this came across my desk the other day. It was Safety Rep magazine that I get sent every so often, and the front page carried a little piece about these structural inequalities that are defining the impact of COVID-19. Unions welcome recommendations set out by Doreen Lawrence in her Labour Party commissioned review into how people from BAME backgrounds are being impacted by COVID-19. The report is known as An Avoidable Crisis, and it found that BAME people have been disproportionately hit by the pandemic as a result of, quote, decades of structural injustice, inequality and discrimination, end of quote. Unison feel the findings are and recommendations reinforce their demands, and this includes an urgent plan for tackling the disproportionate impact of coronavirus on BAME communities and the introduction of a national strategy backed by action to tackle health inequalities. This includes ensuring workplace-related cases of coronavirus are properly recorded, strengthen COVID risk assessments to ensure consistency and giving workers more confidence. Also, they need improvement of access to PPE in all high-risk workplaces. The evidence of racist disparity proves yet again another failure for this government and capitalism in general. This is another example of how this vile mindset of racism is still alive today. I've not read the report fully, but I certainly intend to when I get hold of a copy. Also, in some union news, the General Secretary of the CWU has written to the government asking for key workers like us to be pushed further up the list of those in line to get vaccinated. As we are having interactions with the public and may even have to help out in places, postmen and women should be provided as a matter of good practice, along with all other key workers. Dave, I think you probably know a bit more about this than I do. I've just read
the emails. So we got PCS members at the DWP. They're processing huge amounts of universal credit claims. They've only now been given the kit to work from home because obviously they were piling in these buildings and processing claims and so forth. Obviously, we've written, the CW have written to the government that obviously we should be prioritised because we've been out and about since March, as you know. And as I said, if for those that get up early and have to go to work, please do look at the bus stops about 6 a.m. You'll see loads of cleaners bunched up together. They've all had to work and they're risking themselves as well every single morning, John.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk a little bit about this Operation Blame the Public, which is the latest desperate action from a deeply desperate and miserably failed government here in Britain. You know, people were kicking off the other day about here's some video footage of people piling onto trains at, I think it was Canning Town here in London, and, you know, everyone having to get on. You know, it was 8 o'clock in the morning. What do you think they were doing? Where do you think they were going? They weren't all on their way to an illegal rave, right? So put the blame for this kind of thing where it belongs. So long as people continue to be demanded to go into work, so long as they still need to do that work, so long as they're not being given money to, at the moment, not arrive in a physical workplace every single day in order to make what they need to pay their bills and get by in life, this kind of thing is going to happen. And the way that this, you know, kind of creeps back to a degree of normality is not on them. You know, you've got to understand this. There isn't a choice here. They don't have the choice. A lot of people don't have the choice to stay home. I mean, even in, I consider what we do, Dave, to be, you know, we're well represented by the union, as this example has just shown. And many other examples we've talked about in previous shows and tonight. But I don't have the option to just phone up my place and say, I don't want to come in today. That's not available. You do, however, have the option of not working in a place that you genuinely, any workplace you genuinely believe to be unsafe. That is, of course, Section 44 of the 1996 Safety at Work Act. I think that's the one, isn't it? Safety at Work? Yeah. That's safety work, yeah. Yeah, so that is, yeah, get hold of a copy of that because that gives you the immense amount of protections whether you're a union member or not. But, yeah, you know, this idea of blaming people for misbehaving or whatever, it's just like, listen, this ball had one person holding it and, one institution, if you like, holding it and one that's dropped it, and that's government. Okay, so stop blaming people. People are not going out there. The majority of people during this lockdown, the same as the last two, have behaved and have done what they were supposed to do. All right, stop blaming them for your miserable fucking failure. I mean, it irates the hell out of me, Dave, as you can probably imagine.
It's one thing to talk about workers trying to get on a train at 8 a.m. It's interesting that we're not talking about, and it was reported only in one publication, so when you were closing the pubs at 10, or when...
Yes, exactly.
There was some a mainstream media actually showed the train station at 10:30, which looked like pre-COVID 7 a.m. at Baker Street. It was that bad. And then off-licence owners who were getting, so if you can imagine the queues at off-licences after 10. So the off-licences owners were investigated by a local council saying, look, you're not socially distancing. And they had no answer. They said these people are piling in after 10. And so there were congregation outside off-licences, then immediately afterwards at the train station. So about 10:30, it looked like 7 a.m. post, that's before COVID, at Baker Street. So if we're going to talk about one thing, let's talk about everything. John?
Agreed. Yeah, I agree entirely. That's entirely the point. You know, this very idea of people just not wanting to pay attention, or even worse, this kind of British exceptionalism idea, which is leaned on for either praise or condemnation, whenever certain people feel like it, you know, of, you know, we just don't like doing what we're told, you know, we're such wondrous, outstanding, but bollocks. You know, people will do what's best for themselves and for the communities around them, and they'll stay safe. But they'll do that when they have the opportunity to do that. And you don't have that opportunity if you're not getting paid, because you still need to get paid. You still need to buy your food. You still need to pay some gobshite parasitic landlord a lot of the time. You know, you still need to do these things. So stop pretending that it's just everyone's just being naughty or whatever. It's really disgusting to me. I mean, everything about this government is disgusting to me, but I think that's a point I've put across very well. Yeah, do you want to add anything to that, or shall I just move on to the next thing? Cool. Okay, I'll move on. All right, vaccines. I want to talk a little bit about a vaccine issue this week. So you may have heard that everybody's favourite apartheid states has done rather good business in vaccinating its population so far. Top of the league tables, that would of course be Israel. Not so much for the country that it occupies, though. They have unsurprisingly been denying vaccine requests to the original owners of the land, who they treat like second-class citizens on a good day. 4.5 million Palestinians live under Israel's brutal occupation and are not entitled to the jab, even after the Palestinian Authority have asked for up to 10,000 doses for their frontline workers, but Israel refused. They have paid above the market price, we are informed, in Israel, to get the Pfizer vaccine. So they're also taking part in this vaccine nationalism. But they have used these, and they have used them properly, actually. I've got to give them some credit on this one. So if they've got any leftover vaccines around the end of the day, and what I mean by leftover is those that are being used that day because they can't be refrozen or whatever, and people show up who are not actually on the list for that day or whatever, you can still basically go get there and get a vaccine that day. It doesn't matter which list you're on, doesn't matter which group you're in. And I agree entirely with that. It's something that Andrew Cuomo doesn't appear to be doing in New York. Still, all the liberals love him, but there you are. He's effectively wasting them, throwing them away. So, yeah, Israel's got the right idea on that one. Some of the argument from Israel is that the Palestinian Authority has responsibility for their citizens under the Oslo Accords, but this is disingenuous at best. The country is occupied, and as an occupying force, Israel controls access to everything, especially in and out of Gaza. They have been intentionally starving and bombing the population of Gaza for years, and their health supplies struggle at best. And many people with COVID are not attending hospital because of lack of things like oxygen and those needing advanced care. They also have massive unemployment, so those with jobs are in a hurry to get back to work, not least all the day labourers who cross over into Israel every day via the truly appalling and inhumane system of checkpoints and have to do work on a daily basis on the building sites. Excuse me. As the occupier, Israel must provide for the population under its control under international law. Although this vile place has never cared much about international law or humanity, for that matter, or much else that involves being less of a brutal and racist shithole than it actually is. They have occupied Palestine for 50 years and have shown that their total unwillingness to even see Palestinians as human means that in situations like this, of course, they're not going to give them the vaccines they need. Also important to mention, the Oslo Accords were meant to be a five-year interim agreement. So citing this nearly 30 years later for a pandemic that were most certainly not written to deal with is a bullshit plan to start out in the first place. Plus, there's no safe passage between Gaza and the West Bank that presently exists, as it was supposed to via the supposed accords. And, you know, this has basically not happened. So even while the PA have sought vaccine support from other places, other countries in the world, this does not displace Israel's responsibility to the occupied population that it presides over, according to the Geneva Convention. Meanwhile, there's lots of stories online that Arab Israelis are avoiding the vaccine, and this is for fear that it is dangerous in some way. I cannot imagine why they would think that anything pushed by the Israeli government was likely to endanger them in any way. But to be honest with you, I expect this story is bullshit. If there's any truth here, it's far more likely related to a lack of engagement with Arab communities in letting them know what is happening, where vaccines are being given, etc., etc. That would be the usual trick. there may be some relief here as pressure is mounting and Israel has increasingly looked bad over the years for their appalling treatment of the Palestinians. This is also a country that is losing the fight and they know it. Many younger Jewish people are taking less interest and certainly less unquestioning attitudes towards the occupation. And they are Israel is so scared of the boycott, divestment and sanctions, also known as BDS movement, a totally peaceful movement, that many of their supporters, like the US, are actually trying to ban any kind of support for BDS in truly bizarre, twisted ways that you almost couldn't make up. Certain amounts of state aid for companies or places and people in need end up coming with a caveat of objection to BDS. Very, very random. Anyway, free Palestine and support BDS. That's all I have to say on that one.
Just for any mainstream media, Daily Telegraph listeners, John is not anti-Semitic. John, take it away.
Yeah. It's a real fucking shame that people feel the need to point that blatantly obvious thing out. But there you are. I'm pretty confident in saying I am anti-Zionist. I take that from a good portion of people, my Jewish friends that I know, readings from people like former guest of this show, David Rosenberg, who I'm a big, big fan of. I stand in solidarity with the likes of him and the likes of the Jewish labor movement, things like that. Again, there's not really anything controversial about this. It just depends who you talk to and what they want to make out of it. But Israel is a brutal ethno-fascist apartheid state. Are they the worst country in the world? There's no such thing as the worst country in the world. Everywhere is terrible as far as the people living there can be concerned. Don't play the compare and contrast game. Hey, if you want some examples of other places I don't like Saudi Arabia very much. I particularly hate what they're doing to Yemen. I don't like all of the mad rich cities like Abu Dhabi or whatever they're called. I don't like the staggering level of homophobia in Uganda. And I don't like anything in the present staggeringly corrupt country that is Britain, with a truly awful, awful government. Okay, so last week we talked about some companies to avoid. This was an article found on Ethical Consumer Magazine's website. Excuse me. Again, talking about some of the worst profiteers of the pandemic. This week we're going to look at food, hospitality and travel. Yes, so these little COVID-19 profiteers who we should try and avoid giving any of our money to. First up, no need for a drum roll for this one because I think you know where I'm going when I mention food, hospitality, etc., is Wetherspoons. This is a pretty high-profile example of what we're talking about when the loathsome Tim Martin started moaning about his mock pubs having to be closed and stopped paying his 40,000 staff using a combination of excuses of waiting for furlough to kick in and all this other kind of stuff. The furlough money is for workers, Tim, not for your benefit. You have enough. He stiffed his workers over 0 hours as ever. You know, these ones are on 0 hours contracts. I have no obligation to their employment, et cetera, et cetera. The company got 80% furlough, while the year before they made a profit of £57.9 million. That's a lot of beer. The furlough would have left workers for 5 weeks without pay, the method that he was using for it. But he basically tried to cut off his workforce quite badly. He even suggested his workers should get jobs at supermarkets while he sat back and just creamed profit off of nothing. The workers themselves, the BFAW union, and a social media campaign made them climb down, and employees were even calling to boycott Wetherspoons pubs when they reopened. Martin has been very vocal, and because he's rich, our media pays attention, in saying that pubs should stay open from the very beginning of this. He's kind of shut up about it now because he's been put in his place. But he brought a lot of this anti-lockdown crank crap to the mainstream just so he could keep taking the money and regardless of his staff and his customers' health. Again, we talked about a psychopath in the form of Elon Musk earlier on. Maybe Tim joins his ranks, although far, far less money, you little peasant. Also, I have to say, while I'm not exactly your top pub connoisseur, and they will probably like it when I say this, Wetherspoons are shit. Just don't go to them, for God's sake. you could mock up a better version of a pub in your back bedroom than you could in any other. They're awful. They're awful. But solidarity to the workers there, obviously, and let's get your... get you what you need. But dear God, Tim Martin, what a case he is. Anyway, Britannia Hotels. This is one that passed me by originally, so I thought it's worth mentioning this. They've hit the headlines early in the crisis, sending letters to staff at the Columbridge Hotel near Avonmore, sacking them and ordering them all to leave the company accommodation immediately. So in other words, places where they could have self-isolated to protect themselves and others, they were told, off you go, no money, we don't really care where you go. Again, a social media and political backlash, after which they claimed it was a clerical error and they climbed down. Britannia Hotels operating profit rose in 2019 to 19.3 million. So again, this is the kind of money that these companies are pulling down when they're turning their own staff to the streets. Pretty appalling stuff that they do. Travel Lodge, another big hotel chain. This one is owned by Golden Tress Asset Management, Avenue Capital and Goldman Sachs. Don't know who any of those companies are, but I don't think they're in the hotel business. They're not short of a few quid, that's for sure. After the lockdown was announced, it closed. Travelodge closed premises and threw out homeless families housed there by local councils in many areas, seemingly in defiance of government guidance that said the hotels looking after homeless families should not close. It gave one council 4 hours' notice to relocate vulnerable people, and this included an 84-year-old resident. Pretty appalling, and, well, there you are. It is what it is. EasyJet. This company have specifically been pulled up for handing out £174 million dividends to their shareholders on the 22nd of March last year, when it was obvious that this money would be better suited going to the workers now being laid off. $860 million of this alone went to its billionaire founder. The company then went on to access £600 million bailout loan from the UK Treasury and the Bank of England. Again, what can I say? So, yeah, that's your companies to avoid this week. Right, Dave, did you want to feedback on that?
No, you said Weatherspoon. Look, I'm going to be the centrist head here, but I'm just going to say this. That during March, opening the pubs, and me, Chaz, and Chaz Summers and Pac-Man went to one, Weatherspoon's, local to us, and there was no social distancing or anything like that, and we left. The scanning in or signing in was voluntary, and it was just about taking your money and killing you afterwards. And that, I've got to be honest, and I'm not a pub goer to say the least, especially not, never risk, I'll never do that again, because I saw there was no orderly fashion, no social distancing, and it was just about taking people's money. And you can see where and why this thing spread, and mixed messages, you know. And I feel actually bad by going. We left, as I said, because, you know, by half hour being there, people were just walking all over, you know. It's just terrible, John.
Yeah, one of the main reasons we're still in the condition we're in Britain now, we're in a terrible, terrible state, is that the whole eat out to help out, you know, the reopening of the economy, as they called it, back in the summer. This is what's led a lot of the positions that we're in now. You know, there's evidence out there that particularly the eat out to help out scheme is what led to this. People back in the pubs, back in the restaurants. Rishi Sunak's little idea. Same person who brought a lot of lockdown skeptics into the main seat of power to talk to Boris Johnson, you know, a man whose mind can be changed very easily because he's dim-witted and doesn't really believe in anything. So he needs, you know, he needs to stop this kind of praising Rishi Sunak and you know, the BBC sticking pictures of him in a Superman costume all over their coverage. It's deplorable. It's the kind of thing that you would, your average tin pot dictatorship would be ashamed of. You know, I mean, you want to go back and, you know, you want to criticize the Soviet Union, go back and look at Pravda newspaper and all that. Tell me the difference between that and a lot of the shit that comes out of the British media now. And also, you know, you and I have discussed this, I think, before, Dave, about the BBC, you know, and they talk about we must defend it against privatization. And to be honest, we should stop anything from being privatized. I agree. And we should stop anything from falling into the hands of psychos like Rupert Murdoch, and we should renationalise a lot of things. But I've got to say, after quite a lot of consideration, the more I engage with the BBC, the more I see of it, especially their news coverage, and the more I hear of it, I think, well, what's the difference? What would be the difference? You're just a right-wing mouthpiece anyway. You let the Daily Mail tell you what to do.
Well, to be fair, John, and I'll criticise them. Their live media is terrible and not impartial at all. But I think it's there to antagonise you. But their iPlayer stuff is very unregulated media. It gives you a really balanced, some of their political stuff, some of their documentaries. It's fantastic. I do recommend the Trump show that they showed. It's four pieces. I watched all four today, and it sort of gave me a lead up to the inauguration. I thought, oh my God, this actually happened. It was really, really good. And it gave a perspective, not just from the right, from the left and the centre. Amazing stuff, and I've watched many stuff on BBC iPlayer. You'd almost think you're watching Netflix, you know, it's unregulated media. So, but I, again, John, who watches live TV? I mean, what really? Holmes under the hammer.
It's always funny when you call that live TV, because I associate that with death TV. And what I mean by that is it's a kind of... Do you know what? I was saving this because I want to talk about this when you you and Pam go against me on the 1990s in an upcoming show. But this is something I saw start... I see it as starting in the 90s. It could have started earlier than that. But the use of a lot of daytime TV, which is basically like a kind of quiet drug that's lulling you towards the end of your life. You know, I mean, I think it's aimed at people in certain age groups.
It is. It's people who are getting on, right? And just like the TV on. I know what I'm talking about. I'm telling you, it's just our lovely senior citizens sitting and watching, and it's just on. They don't have to change it or anything.
Yeah, it's just kind of quiet. And, here's some old stuff that you might remember when you were a kid. Look, it's in an antique shop. And here's some people who are engaging in a very kind of, you know, jolly pretend competition for who can sell so much of this. And then when that's over, here's some railway journeys. And don't get me wrong, like, I like the ones about railway journeys. And I have a particular exception until recently when the presentation staff changed for Great Canal Journeys, which I think is a wonderful program. But it is kind of in that same bracket.
Well, look, I've got to be honest. I'm an ITV morning person if I've got time. That's a massive if. So you'll see me watching in a row. And I'm really embarrassed now, folks. In a row, Professional Sweeney Minder. Right? And I laugh. I'm absolutely on the floor laughing with Minder. Yeah. But after that, and to be honest, you can catch Minder on YouTube, all of them, everything. And I'll sit there and watch ITV. But I'm 55 this year, John. What am I going to do? I don't go to Weatherspoon's Minder. So there you go.
That's true. The pub's for the people who still remember those programmes. I remember catching an old episode of The Professionals. It was on the telly somewhere and I couldn't avoid it. And it's like they're running out of the pub, you know, this really intense scene, and they're going to take care of some ruffians who are hanging around their car. And I was like, is this what Secret Services did in the 1980s?
Ruffians. Quick. John, ruffians. Ruffians.
There's ruffians standing
we
near the jack.
We gave them a thorough good beating.
Like, oh God, that is so sad. But shout out to Gordon Jackson, though. He's not with us anymore, but he was great.
Well, he was from Upstairs Downstairs, which is why he was such a popular films. Choice, wasn't he?
He's in Whiskey Galore and stuff. Big, Great Escape, of course.
Again, like many actors from that era, big drinker, John.
Of course, yeah, and Scottish. So not that I'm casting any aspersions on that.
I remember the young ones, they were doing... a sketch from the he was a broom basically, but he was playing Gordon Jackson from Upstairs Downstairs, and he advised a dustpan and brush, don't let master see you, he'll give us a good beating.
I remember that. That was I think that was Robbie Coltrane's voice, actually.
Was Robbie Coltrane.
Yeah, because he was you'll have me to answer to,
and at the end Robbie Coltrane was looking for germs in a cream bun, and there was an elephant behind them. It was a real elephant.
That was a Bambi episode. Yeah. That was brilliant. Oh, that was so good. human beings, a sign of amoebas. No, right, no, don't, because if we go down that road, we will never get out of it. I like to put it on the record, by the way. I fucking hate nostalgia deeply, but there you are. You know that already.
The Young Ones were good, John. The Young Ones.
The Young Ones was amazing. The Young Ones set standards that people today, well, like, and no disrespect to them, but if they're younger, if you weren't there at the time, you don't realise how much it kind of changed. It was completely kind of average and everyday in regards, you know, it was a sitcom. It even had a sofa in the living room. But it was totally off the wall, totally different. Any kind of cutaways, you know, if you watch shows today like Family Guy or whatever, and they have those cutaways jokes, that comes from the Young Ones, you know. That comes from just these kind of random, you know, a scene where suddenly the camera zooms in on a talking matchbox who just says, "Don't look at me, I'm irrelevant."
Well, it's interesting that going back slightly, because we've got 5 minutes, so just on politics on that, so that, I forgot the writer's name, and he was very left-wing.
Oh, Ben Elton.
And so, yeah, and he went so centre, didn't he, John? In his he could almost have been, not right, I wouldn't say that's unfair, but again, it's like if you speak to many Democrats in America, they all started off at Woodstock and stuff like that, and they went so centre. And I always say this, you know, I always say this about left-wing politicians, which are, it's great, you know, you stand up there and you speak and it resonates with a lot of people. I'm always weary of them getting part of the machine. Do you get what I mean, John? You become part of the machine.
For sure. Yeah, and I completely agree.
Which is what happened with Ben Elton. He became part of the machine, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it's odd that he put, it must have been interesting, you know, in the canteen at lunchtime when because Alexei Sayle was on all of the episodes of The Young Ones too, and Ben Elton basically nicked his act for stand-up. So that must have been fun conversation. But yeah, I mean, Alexei Sayle was certainly the one that led this kind of charge. But yeah, you're right, you know, he came on, you know, Channel 4, Friday Night Live and stuff like that, going, you know, constantly haranguing Margaret Thatcher or whatever, and then he's, you know, all of a sudden, like you say, he's middle-aged, middle-class, doing these fucking appalling jukebox musicals, you know, that he's playing, which, you know, make a lot of money, so okay, fine, maybe he was right and I'm wrong, but I know what I like and I know what I hate, and I hate that shit. So, yeah.
Just on today, just to sort of finish off, because it's on the tip of everyone's tongue, so you had Inauguration Day, you know, and I was looking at Mr. Trump, right, and don't get me wrong, everything he did was just, you know, appalling, but it goes to show, and I'm not bigging him up, right, I'm ethnic minority, I'll get it, I'm there, I just, remember, I know him back from the 80s, because I watched boxing, read a lot of boxing, and if you read Don King's biography, every other page is Trump in it, how he exploited boxers, so I know him, black boxers as well, but I will say that everything he said he'd gonna do, he did it by executive order, and that goes to show that politicians, not him, but a politician, has the capability to do something quickly and say, I'm going to do this and do it. And the fact of the matter is, regardless of what you think of him, he did embarrass a lot of politicians who stay centre and don't do anything. He actually went in there and said, I'm going to do something. Good, bad, but it just goes to show, doesn't it?
It does, but I mean, the thing is, he didn't do it. I mean, I tell you what, if you want, I'll just scribble this off, because I wrote down a couple of things, so I'll knock this off in 2 minutes. Okay, so yeah, it's good to see the end of the Trump era. I haven't got any faith in the new administration, and I suspect they will open the door for things to get even worse in 4 years' time, unfortunately. But I'm naturally glad to see the back of this dismal little billionaire and his pathetic family. What I would really like to see the back of, though, and I know we won't, is just the really awful, toxic mindset that he brought to the mainstream. It's really too much, really, to keep hearing these people talk about their voice being unheard. You know, I even heard someone the other day talking about, so, you know, why did you storm the Capitol building? Well, we felt that we're being unheard. Your representative, is what I'd say to these people, your representative held the most powerful position in the world politics for 4 years. We never get away from your voice. The voice of the self-made white victimhood that has no basis in reality rings out from absolutely everywhere. And the whining grievance culture of those who cannot produce culture, endlessly claiming it is being taken away. 4 years of hard right authoritarianism in power, You know, he didn't really do, he did the two things he was supposed to, and all of you are still sitting there being very, very angry. So this is it. You know, the things that he advocated, the things that Trump advocated and spoke about were not only hateful and false, they were totally untrue. And that's the main factor why they failed. You know, this is the main factor why ultimately you need to stand up to all forms of racism. But the reason why those groups always fail is A, we stand up to them, and B, the stuff they advocate is just basically crap. It doesn't work. So, yeah, you know, what did Trump do? Well, he didn't build a wall. He never stopped the carnage of America that he talked about in his inauguration. In fact, he grew it. He showed really to me the psychotic empty scream at the heart of the politics of the right. But what he did manage to do is pass Paul Ryan's tax cuts for the rich, put a load of conservative wingnuts on a Supreme Court, including an alcoholic rapist, and he helped to guide an already suffering country even further into the total clusterfuck of late period capitalism. And that's before we had COVID-19. And in the meantime, his supporters and his fan base just sat back and played the victim again. And they'll keep playing it because it's the only role they've ever learned how to play. I don't take to this idea of any of the grievance that people supposedly had around him. But yeah, you are right that to some degree the mindset of getting... I mean, yeah, he has, you know, it has shamed a lot of the mainstream politics over there, including, as I say, the new administration. I mean, you know, how's anything going to be made? Kamala Harris is someone who made her name sticking loads of particularly black people in prison in parts of mass incarceration for like possession of marijuana or some bullshit. I mean, come on, man. You know, could I just say one other thing actually in closing though? I just want to say, you know, you talk about, we're the victims of this and people aren't listening to us. And you just, as I've said, you just had a president. Okay. You know who wouldn't have made that position? Someone who definitely wouldn't have got there. That would have been someone like Martin Luther King. Because for all the talk of what a great man he is considered now in America and around the world, he was intensely unpopular even when he was killed. And he represented an empowerment for the truly disempowered, not just black people, but working class people, who he supported to the absolute last. He was supporting striking workers when he was killed, and his mainstream advocates today always play down or ignore his socialism, which I think is disgusting. As I've said a few times this evening, you know, Britain, endlessly failing government, consistently relying on patriotic tropes and scapegoating to try and hide their disastrous time in power. You know, if you were able to line up either, you know, obviously not physically, metaphorically, line up something to represent all of the dead that have happened in Britain during the coronavirus, well over 80,000, some estimates have got it close to 100,000. If you walked through this terrible line whistling Rule Britannia, you wouldn't actually achieve anything. So that's what you can do with your patriotism. But yeah, so in closing, Dave, on the Trump thing, sure, he achieved the things he was supposed to achieve, and that's why he was supported by, you know, the Republicans in power. And then when he'd finished that and he just became too gibbering and toxic and going on about an election that he never won, they cut him loose. But what did you think was going to happen? That's business, you know? That's what he was there for.
Thank you very much, John.
I'm not sad to see the back of him.
No, not at all. I hope he. I think they'll arrest him shortly. Anyway,
well, you're quite possibly. You're absolutely right, though. I mean, watching him tear through a lot of the Republicans, like Ted Cruz and Jeb Bush. I mean, Jeb Bush, like, why are you here? I mean, that was funny. Yeah, that was really funny.
Yeah.
You know. So, and he helped to put an end to another just god awful family of warmongering, overprivileged psychos. So. Yeah. Swings and roundabouts.
John, we'll be back next week at 7 PM UK time. Thanks, John.
Cheers, mate. Thanks a lot.
John Bouts, all the rage, all the rage. On Trax FM. Trax FM. Trax FM. Trax FM. Trax FM.